This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The day after Eric Richens was found dead in his bed, Corey closed on a real estate deal. Alone. Then people came to the house. There was a gathering at the home where hours earlier, EMTs had noted her husband appeared to have been dead for some time. Break out the Tostitos and party dip! Most people would hear that and stop. Who does that? But if you're trying to understand the psychology of Corey Richens, not judge it, understand the machinery behind it. The gathering might be the most important behavioral data point in the entire case. Because a psychotherapist might look at that and see something more disturbing than callousness. They might see normalcy. Her normalcy. The possibility that for Corey, the day after Eric's death wasn't a performance of being okay. It was her actually being okay. Because in the room she'd already moved into, a terrible thing happened and life continues. The room where she put fentanyl in a drink is sealed. She's not in it anymore. And the room she's standing in now is the one where a businesswoman closes her deal and friends come by because something awful happened and she needs the company. That distinction between performing normalcy and inhabiting it is the key to understanding everything Corey did for the next 14 months. Let's start with the 911 call, shall we? And by the way, this is the second part in our Corey Richens Broken Brain series as we try to break down and not necessarily judge, but try to understand the modality behind the broken brain and decision processes of Corey Richens. That 911 call, 3 a.m. She's hysterical, sobbing, barely able to answer the dispatcher's question. She told investigators she'd fallen asleep in one of her son's room. When she came back to the bedroom, she found Eric cold, like putting your arm over a cement brick. The grief was audible. The story was bullshit. The panic was convincing enough that the initial response treated this as a sudden death. But Eric's sister later testified that when she arrived at the scene, Corey appeared well put together, hair done, in the middle of the night. That juxtaposition matters, not because it proves she was acting, but because it reveals the speed at which someone with this psychology can shift between emotional states that serve different purposes. The hysterical call establishes the grieving wife on tape. The composed appearance when family arrives serves a different function. Control the room, manage the narrative, be the person in charge of what happens next. Most people can't switch between those modes that quickly. Someone whose emotional expression is organized around utility rather than genuine feeling can. Then the Google searches started. How long does life insurance companies take to pay? If someone is poisoned, what does it go down on the death certificate as? What is considered a lethal dose of fentanyl? Can cops force you to do a lie detector test? My personal favorite, luxury prisons for the rich in America. Have you found that luxury prison yet, Corey, as you're watching us on your iPad sneering? Hi. How's the commissary? They got beef jerky this week? How to permanently delete information from an iPhone remotely? Can deleted text messages be retrieved? When does FBI get involved in a case? Read those not as evidence of guilt. Read them as a priority list because that's what they are psychologically. These aren't the searches of a grieving widow, but they're also not the searches of a panicking criminal trying to cover tracks. They're the searches of a project manager assessing the status of a project. Where are the risks? What are the timelines? What's the contingency? How fast does the money arrive? What are the prisons like if this goes wrong? She's troubleshooting, not mourning. The emotional bandwidth that should be consumed by grief is instead dedicated to operational questions, and mixed in with the operational questions, a search for her own net worth. Corey Richens-Comas net worth. She Googled herself to see what the world thought she was worth, while her husband's cause of death was still pending. That search is the one that stops you, not because it's incriminating in the traditional sense, but because it tells you what her mind was focused on in the days after Eric's death. Not loss, not children, not what happened, her brand, her image. What does the outside world see when it looks at Corey Richens? That's the question consuming her while her husband's toxicology report is still being processed. Grief for most people is totalizing. It floods every channel. You can't think about insurance payments or payouts when you're devastated by loss because the devastation consumes you. But for someone whose emotional architecture is organized into sealed compartments, grief and logistics can coexist. The widow who misses her husband and the woman who needs to know about death certificates and prison amenities can both be active simultaneously because they occupy different rooms. They never bump into each other in the hallway. And then she did the thing most people still can't wrap their heads around. She wrote a children's book. She had a ghost written. Are You With Me? Self-published in March of 23, 1 year after Eric's death, about 2 months before her arrest. The cover shows a father with angel wings watching over his son. Corey went on Good Things Utah, local ABC4 lifestyle show, to promote it. She sat on camera and talked about helping her boys process their father's unexpected death. Just because he's not present there with us physically, that doesn't mean his presence isn't there with us, she said. The prosecution framed the book as deflection, a calculated move to position herself as a grieving mother, not a suspect, and it was deflection. But it may have been something more complex. It may have been Corey building the version of reality she needed to inhabit. And this is what I keep coming back to when I try to make sense of the decision she made during this period. I'm not inside her head, but the pattern of behavior tells a story. And the story isn't just about covering tracks. It's about a brain that processes reality different than yours or mine. This is where a concept from clinical psychology becomes essential. Some personality structures don't experience deception the way most people understand it. The lie isn't a performance maintained through discipline and effort. It's migration. The person doesn't stand outside the lie and deliver it. They move into it. They unpack. They decorate. The original facts don't disappear entirely, but they get archived in a room that doesn't get visited. Eric's death becomes an unexpected tragedy, not because she's lying to the camera, but because in the room where she is a mother and an author, it was unexpected. The room where she put fentanyl in a drink exists, but she's not visiting it right now. She's in the room where a loving mother wrote a book to help her children heal. And in that room, the grief is real. The mission is real. The performance isn't a mask over the truth. It's an alternate truth she's built and moved into. If that's not creepy as shit, I don't know what is. That's what makes someone with this psychology so convincing. They're not suppressing tells. They're not fighting micro expressions. They believe what they're saying in the moment they're saying it, because the version of themselves doing the talking has been walled off from the version who did the thing. It's not acting. It's migration. And the people around her confirmed it. Friends testified at trial that Corey appeared financially successful, put together, a good mother dealing with a terrible loss. They didn't see through the performance because there was no performance in the traditional sense, no mask to slip. The woman they were spending time with in the compartment she was occupying genuinely was a grieving mother rebuilding her life, and that's why nobody saw it coming. You can't detect a lie when the person telling it doesn't experience it as one. Eric's own family saw something different. His sisters grew suspicious almost immediately. But the friends, the people Corey chose to surround herself with, the ones still standing by her to this day, known as flying monkeys, the audience she curated saw exactly what she wanted them to see, and they testified to it under oath as proof that the prosecution's version couldn't be right. She seemed fine. She seemed like a grieving mother moving forward. That testimony intended to help her is actually the most damning evidence of how complete the migration was. The constructed reality fooled the people who spent the most time inside it. In April of 23, Corey emailed Summit County preemptively, before anyone had publicly accused her of anything specific, to explain her exotic vacations since Eric's death, his alleged affair, her mental health, and her supposed lack of financial problems. Proactive reputation management. She felt suspicion building, which means part of her understood why it existed, but she also believed, while typing that email, that the right explanation would make it all go away. Awareness and confidence running on parallel tracks that never intersect. That email is the psychology in miniature. She addresses the vacation. She means she knows they look bad. She addresses Eric's alleged affair, which means she's already constructed a counter narrative where he's the flawed one. She addresses the finances, which means she knows people are asking questions. Every item she preemptively explains is an item she knows looks suspicious, and yet the act of explaining them feels to her like resolution. Like once people hear the context, the questions will just stop. That confidence in her own explanatory power, the belief that the right story told well enough resolves anything, is the same mechanism that will later produce a children's book, a walk the dog letter, a fiction novel defense, and a 45-minute sentencing speech. The scale changes, the mechanism doesn't. The TV tour is where this psychology reaches its most disturbing expression. Going on television to promote a children's grief book while you are the reason those children are grieving requires a specific capacity most people don't possess. It requires the ability to inhabit a constructed identity so completely that the performance generates no anxiety, no tell, no moment where the real self bleeds through, because there is no real self to bleed through. There's just the room she's in right now. And right now, she's a grieving mother helping her children. That's the truth of this moment. The other truth is in a room she's not visiting. And she didn't do one interview and retreat. She leaned in, went on local radio, went on the lifestyle show. She promoted the book on social media. She engaged with the public as a grieving mother for months. Each appearance was another coat of paint on the new room. Each interaction, another piece of furniture. The more she performed the role, the more real it became. Not as a strategy, but as a psychological migration. Every sympathetic comment, every message from a parent who related to the book, every moment of public validation reinforced the constructed identity and made the sealed room a little harder to remember. The question most people ask is, did she believe her own story? And the answer nobody finds satisfying? Yes and no, simultaneously, depending on which room she was standing in when you asked. If you caught her at 3 a.m. alone with the Google searches, she knew. If you caught her on a TV set holding up a book with angel wings on the cover, she was a grieving mother. Both were real. Neither was the whole truth. And the architecture that kept them separate was the same architecture that allowed her to pour a drink, go to another room, and wait. The performance held for 14 months, from March 22 to May 23. And then on May 8th, the arrest came. There's something about this kind of psychology that nobody talks about enough. It's not unsettling because of what it hides. It's unsettling because of what it reveals about sincerity. Corey may have meant every word on that TV segment, every sentence of that email to the country, every page of that book. She may have held her children and felt genuine tenderness while knowing in a sealed-off corner of her mind exactly what she had done to their father. The tenderness and the truth coexisting, never touching, both completely real. That's what should unsettle you more than anything else in this case. Not a woman who faked grief to cover a murder. That story makes sense. A woman who migrated into genuine grief, who built a room where the loss was real and lived inside it, while the room next door held the reason it happened. That story makes you wonder how many rooms you'd never see if you were standing in someone else's house. The arrest ended the TV tour. It didn't end the migration. From a jail cell with recorded phone lines and monitored mail, the narrative machine kept running. It just had to work harder. And the desperation of what it produced next tells you more about the compulsion driving it than anything she did while she was free. That's coming up. Press subscribe so you don't miss it. We're diving into it in our next chapter. We'll continue our conversation in the comment section and Substack and YouTube. Until then, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.